All right, real NBA basketball to talk about here on the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. I'm joined tonight by Danny LaRue. Danny, what's up?
Doing well. Excited that we got to have the chance again to see Stephen Curry play basketball.
I have to say, I really missed these 1 a.m. Pacific time conversations that we used to have during the playoffs last year. I'm so glad that that is back now. For those of you who are relatively new listeners to the show, at least since last playoffs, we've done the season previews, a lot of kind of more conceptual off-season type of stuff, cap stuff. We'll still get some of that through the season, but probably two or three nights a week, we're going to kind of do recaps of the night's action as well as news and try to give you some broader takeaways as well from the night's action. It's not just going to be straight game breakdowns for the most part, since the regular season games aren't as important as playoff games are. But we'll be recording Sunday through Thursday nights during the week here on the West Coast, so it's there for you in the mornings when you go to work, if you're on the East Coast or the West Coast for that matter. And we'll probably also be having some team-centric guests on, or maybe some other national writers, just to kind of shoot the breeze as well a couple, three times a week. And that's what the show's going to be. So if you have any suggestions for shows or any feedback on that schedule, please let us know on Twitter. We should probably start with the Warriors-Pelican game. Danny?
I think we should, and it's hard to take a lot away from that game just because of the mash unit that New Orleans is putting out there, but Stephen Curry put on a show, and something else that we talked about was something that came into play in the finals as well, which is that Klay Thompson didn't really have a big box score. He also got in foul trouble, which is something those who listened last year remember that I harp on with some frequency. But
yeah, and he had seven turnovers.
Yeah, and he had seven turnovers, but what Klay brings to this offense is incredibly valuable because teams respect his shot so much.
Yeah, they do. And you can see, there's one play where Nate Robinson on the backside of a pick and roll, no matter who you're guarding, you'll almost always have at least some kind of help responsibilities. And Nate Robinson just basically stuck to him, and Steph drove and threw it to Klay thinking he'd be open. And Nate Robinson was just right there in his grill, having never left, essentially. And that's the way the Pelicans were playing him all night, whether he was on the strong side or the weak side of a lot of those pick and rolls, and they stopped him. Klay was pressing a little bit. I think he only had seven shot attempts, but he opens the floor up so much, and that means a ton. One thing I probably want to ask him at practice tomorrow, I didn't get a chance to talk to anyone after the game, is just if they're okay with that kind of a shots for Klay, assuming that it's opening everything up for others.
Yeah, if you're going to play 4-on-4 functionally, then there isn't really a better player right now in the NBA to do it with than Stephen Curry.
Yeah, so the other takeaway from this game for me was, New Orleans is every bit as bad as I expected them to be without, the five NBA players or so that are out of their lineup right now.
Yeah, and I was having trouble figuring out who they missed most other than Drew Holiday, because Drew would have kind of run the offense and defended, though he is on a minutes restriction.
Yeah, he sat for rest since it was on the front end of a back-to-back, and that's even more troubling. Not troubling in the sense that they're doing the wrong thing, but troubling in the sense that they're going to really struggle without him at first. I mean, he's on a 15-minute limit, and he's not playing back-to-backs, it seems, at the start of the year.
And so you had players there. Nate Robinson got to the team pretty recently, from what I remember, and Ish Smith joined their team yesterday. So they
and you could see that just during the game, they had no idea where to go on offense. Ish Smith had one walkthrough before the game, Coach Gentry was saying afterwards. So they that'll get a little bit better. But, yeah, I mean, those guys, too, are just – there's a reason that they're available for absolutely nothing in the past week.
Yeah, so the guy I was thinking about how much they were missing him was Quincy Pondexter, because one of the structural flaws with the Pelicans as presently constituted is that a lot of the players, other than him, that they play at small forward are naturally other positions. And so he fills a gap for them that they don't really have, and Dante Cunningham has tried that, but he doesn't space the floor credibly for a three. He's more valuable as a four in that way. and they just don't have a player who you can just kind of plug and play and just set him out there, defend that position, and hit some open shots. They just don't have an extra guy at that spot right now.
Yeah, I saw Cupon being put through his paces by Pelicans' assistant before the game. He doesn't look anywhere close to ready. It was his left knee that he had worked on. It's still that leg is still visibly not as large just from a musculature standpoint as the right leg. He really wasn't able to jump at all on the shots he was going through. He was practicing floaters off his right leg because I presume, which you wouldn't normally do as a right-handed player, but I presume he was just taking him just because he can't even do like a floater without even jumping off his left leg. So I think he's just based on that, not being a physical therapist, but I would guess he's a month away, if not more. They don't really have a timetable. And I asked their beat writer, John Reed, exactly what he had done because it wasn't quite reported. And he said he had some cartilage removed or operated on. He wasn't sure exactly what. But so that would indicate, I think, that Pondexter is not going to be back anytime soon. Although, at the very least, he looked like he was in pretty good shape from a body composition standpoint. So that's encouraging.
One factor from this that was tweeted out after a couple of us had talked about it by a friend of the show, Seth Partnow, was about Anthony Davis as a creator. And so last season, just under 30% of Davis's attempted field goals were what are called self-created, and they were the effective field goal percentage was more than 10% lower on those than when he had it created for him.
Yeah, 43.5%. When he created them, basically that means by Partnow's metric that it was not the result of what he calls a potential assist, basically meaning a pass that would be an assist if the shot went in. So that's what he describes as self-created, basically something where you're holding the ball for more than a second or two before shooting it. And he was not able to get anything going 1-1 in this game, just like he wasn't really in the playoffs. The difference in the playoffs is that he's such a great finisher of plays that he was able to take advantage of the openings that were created both by his presence as a screener, but also credible threats going to the basket like Evans and like Holiday when Holiday was able to play. And also they had more shooting around him as well. They didn't have guys like Perkins in there who actually played pretty well offensively, but is not part of that is because he is basically being treated as a non-threat.
Yeah, I mean, we have to mention it just because it was so amusing that he did score in double figures and to have that game. But what makes New Orleans hard to kind of figure out where they're going to go during this time is that other than Davis, what I just kept on being struck with was something that I've talked about on when we talked about the season preview podcast is just how are they going to beat people right now because they're just so undermanned.
Yeah, the most discouraging thing for me, other than the fact that just they're totally undermanned and they're going to struggle, was I thought that AD did not have a very good game defensively. And a big part of that, too, is just the communication was not there with the point guards. He was worried a lot about the shooters, but the Warriors drove past him time and again, and he finally got a shot block on, I forget who it was.
Stephen Curry.
Yeah, it was Steph, yeah, like right up by the corner of the backboard, but aside from that, he just kept getting driven by. He wasn't able to do a good job of helping and recovering to his man. The Pelicans also gave up a 47% offensive rebound rate to the Warriors through the competitive portion of the game, and a lot of that was because their bigs were so far from the hoop trying to guard Golden State shooters. That's about all I have to say on this game. Golden State looked good. Their defense wasn't great in the first quarter, but that's because Ish Smith and Perkins combined to go 9-for-9. They predictably did not continue that. And then the Warriors defense was the same excellent unit that we have known after that point.
The only thing I'll say is, again, this was a game that felt like it was over if you're being charitable, early in the fourth quarter. But
I thought it was over right when John Reed tweeted out what the Pelicans starting lineup was going to be.
Fair enough. But I think that what concerned me was New Orleans plays tomorrow night, actually tonight, based on when we're recording this. And they played Davis into the fourth quarter. The Warriors played their guys. And I know some of that is getting them back into rhythm, but I'm paranoid at this point about injuries. So I just think like once a game is settled, just get those guys out.
Alvin Gentry also waited until the second quarter to bring in Ryan Anderson. And while I understand that two of their healthy players, Ajinsa and Perkins, were centers. He's probably the second best player available. So that means that you might want to play him a little bit earlier than the second quarter. And yeah, AD looked like he was on pace to play a ton of minutes until they finally took him out at the end. But yeah, they were down 21 with 10 minutes left, and they brought AD back in after a two-minute rest, which was going to kind of be his only rest of the half. So we'll see whether Alvin Gentry, especially during this time period when AD is going to be trying to carry the team, what his minutes load is going to be like. It looks like it's going to be difficult. And AD, obviously, he had by far the worst game I've ever seen him play tonight.
Do you want to go to the Bulls, or do you want to go to the Pistons game?
Let's go Pistons, because I think this is the game out of the three tonight that actually has the most predictive power, just because the Pelicans and Cavs are kind of shells of what we ultimately expect them to be. Detroit blitzed Atlanta in this game.
Yeah, I ended up watching the third quarter after we got back from Oracle, and what I noticed was this really strange thing that I was kind of getting a feel for it, because I knew that broadly what happened that the Pistons did well, but I was sitting there and I was watching Detroit's offense and thinking, you know, oh, they're doing okay, and I was a little bit disappointed with Atlanta, and then I realized that Atlanta hadn't scored a point. And it was just one of those realizations, and so the lead went from 5 to 13 in a stretch where Detroit wasn't super efficient, but Atlanta just didn't get a single bucket, and then from there, it just kind of escalated.
Yeah, their defense looked excellent in this game, talking about the Pistons. And one thing I was really impressed by was just the mobility of Kentavious Caldwell-Pope.
Mm-hmm.
He was guarding Kyle Korver for most of the game, really only had one or two lapses on him, but unlike most guys who are guarding Korver, was actually able to be very effective as a help presence. And Caldwell Pope was a really good guy coming out of Georgia from a steal standpoint. His quickness for the two guard was evident, and now he seems to be putting it together on when to help and when to recover. He gummed up a lot of actions, a lot of post-ups Detroit did it. A fair amount of switching as well, like we saw the Hawks opponents do in the playoffs last year. That was pretty effective. And then on those ISOs, Pope and Stanley Johnson as well did a great job with this, where he was able to dig down, still get back to his man. He was excellent. He got in the passing lanes. He's just, his lateral quickness for a two guard was fantastic and really, really impressed me.
And his range was crazy. I mean, there were a couple shots that he took, it seemed like with pure confidence, and they just went in from far past the three-point line.
Yeah, from Detroit's standpoint, their starters destroyed Atlanta's, and which was a surprise for people who saw the Hawks starters be so good last year, and then in the playoffs, that was really the unit that was able to be so effective before they all got hurt in the Cleveland series. But Detroit, I worried a little bit about their backup point guard position and their backup center position. I did not see anything to alleviate those worries in this game. It was Steve Blake getting the minutes over Spencer Dinwiddie. He didn't really do much. Dennis Schroeder just completely abused him. And Schroeder had a really nice game with 20 points on 14 shots. And then Aaron Baines got repeatedly taken advantage of in pick and roll defense. That's an area of concern, but I still think that, Detroit looked great, so I shouldn't quibble too much. Another thing I would point to, Andre Drummond shot 6 out of 16, 6 out of 10 from the line, and Drummond was 0 of 7 on post-ups.
It was crazy watching it, because when you think about, and this, watching Jahlil Okafor in college is kind of a good example of this, if you think about what can happen from a post-up, and it wasn't like he was not scoring and there were these other things, like he was making passes to guys, though that did happen sometimes. It just seemed like it was the strangest hub for an offense, because that part wasn't working, but a lot of other things were.
Yeah, it wasn't. And they went to him early in each half, and he just really wasn't close on any of those plays. He doesn't have the skill level to make a shot outside of the restricted area right now, frankly. And he did have some effectiveness drawing a lot of fouls, whether it was loose ball fouls in the offensive glass. He had 8 offensive rebounds. Detroit had a 41% offensive rebound percentage in this game, which was, defensive rebounds were a bugaboo for Atlanta last year. Splitter was supposed to help with that. That did not occur in this game, really. Although Splitter did okay as part of a Hawks bench unit that was able to make up some of the ground that the starters had lost. But yeah, I mean, and Drummond was able to get some transition post-ups right under the rim and got like one bucket that way. But the straight post-ups, just, I think those have just got to go. He's not ready yet. I don't know, Frank. I don't think he's actually ever going to be ready with that. For everyone who said, oh, Dwight Howard was so unskilled, he at least was able to develop decent touch with the hook shot, and Drummond just does not have that.
I feel like we need to talk about Kent Bazemore too. That's part of the storyline for me of the Hawks now, is that they're going to probably keep trying guys as that fifth starter. And I mean, it's a single game, but what I saw, the problem is that he doesn't fit the ecosystem that they have, because when you think about the way that their offense works, you can't have somebody who has so much trouble scoring, because it takes away space from everyone else.
Yeah, Bazemore, through the competitive portion of this game, went scoreless. I had been encouraged by the fact he was hitting his threes, being a little more aggressive in the preseason, but he was not able to translate into the game tonight. He got abused by Marcus Morris because Bazemore is kind of playing the stopper at the three. He's not strong enough or tall enough really to hold up against a guy like Marcus Morris, who's a pretty good post-up three. He started the three. Ilya Sova started the four and had a nice game. So that was a concern. Cephalosha actually played great defensively.
He had
four steals in the first half, and he looked good. But the problem with Cephalosha is the Hawks love to swing the ball from side to side. And let's say you run something with Teague on the left side of the floor, you know, a dribble handoff, a post, or a pick and roll, and then the defense, everybody rotates over, and you reverse the ball to Cephalosha. If he doesn't have a wide open three, which takes him an hour to get off, by the way, then the possession is kind of just dead. It just dies in his hand. He's not able to continue pushing the advantage to drive and then kick, or, you know, make a play himself in pick and roll. He's just not really able to do that, and has not really been able to do that throughout his career. I thought he looked great athletically after that injury, so that's encouraging. And I would guess he probably ends up starting ultimately, unless they feel like he just can't handle the minutes. But I don't know. I think just him, he's just such an offensive downgrade from what Carroll was able to give them last year.
I still think there's a chance it's Justin Holiday.
He didn't play at all tonight.
No, I just feel like
Tim Hardaway was inactive mysteriously. I don't think we ever got an explanation on whether he was injured or something. Lamar Patterson played off the bench. I don't want to talk about him a ton, but he had a couple of flashes. He hit a couple of threes. He had a couple of nice drives, and I'm sorry, he only hit one three, but he had a nice drive. Just enough to make me think, all right, I gotta keep an eye on this guy a little bit.
Yeah, that was actually kind of a pattern for me from the guards with the Hawks, was that there were stretches where it felt like they could get where they wanted to on the floor. Schroeder torched Steve Blake, and Teague had his moments too, but they weren't able to translate that into reliable possession, into reliable buckets. And I thought, just in the parts that I saw, that it felt like the Hawks were settling more often than I remember them doing last year. You know, maybe it was a Millsap corner three that was a little bit contested, or whatever it was. That it was something that happened early in the year with the Warriors last year too, which is that they didn't believe that they could get a better shot, but they definitely can.
Yeah, that's a good point. I also think it's worth noting what the Pistons are doing from a rotational standpoint with their forwards, which I like. They basically played Stanley, Ilyasova, and Marcus Morris as a three-man rotation at the forwards, which you don't normally see because the three and the four are kind of different. But Marcus Morris was able to play the four. He played the four pretty extensively. When they'd bring in Stanley, then they just move Morris to the four, or Stanley could play with Ilyasova as well. Ilyasova's jumper looks good. It's looked good. Shot 40% of threes last year. Looked good at Eurobasket. He actually hit like a couple of step-back threes in this game, 3 of 6 on threes overall. So just getting that extra space around Drummond, and then still with that lineup being able to punish the Hawks on the offensive glass as well. It's a very impressive performance from Detroit. And also, I thought Stanley looked fantastic, and you can see it's not going to be there every night for these young guys. KCP's not going to score 21 points on 14 shots the way he did in this game. And Stanley was 3 of 10, but he showed some really nice ability in pick and roll. He was able to split a pick and roll one time, set up at a couple of assists out of pick and roll as well. And if you look long-term at the Pistons with Reggie Jackson, KCP, Stanley Johnson, that athleticism at those three positions, and then all those guys being able to run pick and rolls, Reggie Jackson's shot looked pretty decent when they went under on him. And then when you got KCP and Stanley both able to shoot an open shot or be able to attack in pick and roll, that's, you know, starting to look like a pretty solid, versatile team in a couple of years.
And they also have guys right now at the power forward position. If you can theoretically slot those guys in, that fit what you're looking for. You know, that can, for certain teams, that can be a pitfall. But for this team, Ilyasova, if in the short term, maybe Marcus Morris in the longer term, maybe they're not the primary answer, but if they can give you 20 minutes a game, let's say, that's a huge part of this puzzle. Because what one of the things that I think I've appreciated more from the Celtics and teams like that is that you do need, in today's NBA, you do need 48 competent minutes. Like, that buys you a lot of latitude everywhere else. And I feel like they're closer to that than I thought they were.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just that backup point guard and backup center is what I might worry about. But yeah, Jody Meeks didn't really play that much in this game. Looks like Anthony Tolliver actually was inactive. I'm not sure why that would have been. But he didn't play at all, obviously. Maybe he's hurt or something. But yeah, it was...
Can he get a really DNP hurt. Better options? Is that...
I thought he would get minutes for this team. But yeah, I really like what they did with the forwards, splitting it between those guys. And then with all of those guys, they're able to switch any action between the three and the four. And that was something that worked well for them also. All right, any other thoughts on this game before we get to Bulls and Cavs?
One very quick thing. From what you've seen, do you feel like if they theoretically did something with Teague, how do you think Schroeder would adapt to facing starters more of the time?
Oh, too early to say. Schroeder had an encouraging game, to be sure, but you know he's being guarded by Steve Blake, so let's see what happens when he's going. And they ran a 2-point guard lineup a little bit in this game too, but let's see how he looks when he's going against some a little bit better of backups.
Fair enough.
All right, so Bulls Cleveland. What was your initial takeaway from this game?
I feel like Mirotić starting gives them, it's so weird to say this, but it feels like it gives them kind of an edge, if you're thinking about it in that way. Just like it makes them a little bit more dangerous for whatever reason, because it gives them an offensive identity, and it takes away something that teams could hide against the Bulls, and especially when Rose and Butler are doing well offensively, which for stretches of time they were tonight, but not as much. You know, there were moments of encouragement and discouragement from Rose. But what I feel like Mirotić, he kind of allows all those other pieces to work together so much better offensively.
Yeah, interesting minutes breakdown in this game in the front court, which is something we're all watching for the Bulls. Mirotić was a plus nine in 25 minutes. Noah may have ended up closing the game, although he didn't attempt a field goal, but he was very solid on the boards, had four assists, looked pretty spry defensively, but then he had a knee contusion, his right knee. It's not the surgically repaired one. Doesn't sound serious. He may actually play against Brooklyn tomorrow, but he was ruled out by the trainers, even though Hoiberg wanted to put him back in. So he played 17 minutes, Gasol 31 minutes, and Taj Gibson 22, but he fouled out. So it seems like a pretty decent minutes distribution, maybe a little bit less Powell. The Bulls managed to avoid getting killed on the offensive glass. That was a big key for them, is that their front court, which really got dominated by Cleveland's front court in the playoffs last year, was able to outplay pretty much the Cleveland front court. But I mean, the biggest problem is you can't take much away from this from Cleveland, because they just don't have enough healthy guys, other than the fact that they may struggle, much as the Pelicans are going to for a while. But, you know, for maybe a month or so, maybe you can take something away, but nothing beyond that, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about Rose and his game? I just had trouble figuring out really what, and sometimes it was what he wanted to do, I guess, more than what he actually did.
What do you mean by that?
There were moments where he was settling for threes and settling for shots, and then you'd be sitting there like, oh God, is it going to be that again? And then he would have this beautiful pass or a beautiful drive or something like that. And I sometimes with him, I feel like I can get a feel for his game and what he wants to do out there. But then other nights, like tonight, I just kind of felt like it was, I think the term that Bill Simmons used, kind of like trick or treat with Tony Allen when he was a young guy. But that idea that there isn't necessarily a rhyme or reason to his objectives out there.
I liked Rose's shot selection this game. He took a corner three, which I think had the shot clock running down, and then he took one bad three with the hand in his face, but at least it was off the catch, a set shot. He was 3 of 5 from mid-range, 2 of 5 in the lane, non-restricted area, and only 3 of 10, actually, at the rim. Mozgov was just hanging out right under the basket, and in a lot of that, too, was when Gasol was in. So in those situations, he's going right into Mozgov's body. He needs to either go for the floater, because he's not going to score over Mozgov. He doesn't have that level of athleticism anymore. Mozgov's a real tough guy to score at right at the rim. So maybe he should be looking for Gasol there, trying to find people a little bit more. So he had a little bit of tunnel vision in this game. One of the things, actually, in just looking at the overall box score, other than the pace, it was just pretty much a very similar game to the way the Bulls played last year.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about LeBron, or do you want to stay on the Bulls for now?
I mean, what do you think of LeBron? He looked pretty good to me. 12 out of 22 from the field. I guess the only thing you could look at is his jumper still doesn't really look to be on.
Yeah, what frustrated me, and this has been true for a couple of years now, is not that he takes jump shots. It's when he does it early in the shot clock, and it kind of that feeling if you could do better. If later on, if that's all you can get, that's fine. But when he's shooting a three with like 13 seconds left on the shot clock, as much as I like to be optimistic about him, Cleveland's has enough offensive talent that they should be able to fight for something better in those next 10-plus seconds.
Well, I don't know if they do right now, frankly, because I was thinking about it for this team, and with Love working his way back, Mozgov coming back from surgery, Tristan Thompson looking a little doughy to me. Did you agree with that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and Love, I mean, he ended up putting a decent stat line, but he was just drilling shots late. Most of that game, he was struggling in terms of getting his shot and hitting a shot.
Yeah, and Mirotić was able to attack him one-on-one, which with some success. He hit that one ridiculous pull-up three from, like, 28 feet right.
That was magnificent.
Space, which was enjoyable. But who is an above-average player on this team right now, at least until Love can work back into things after pretty much an entire summer off due to that rotator cuff surgery? Other than LeBron, they don't really have anyone that you can count on to play at an above-average level right now.
Yeah, I mean, they have players like Mozgov and JR who are talents, but they're not consistent enough to say, okay, you know, well, you're going to get blank from them, and then you can, you know, try to get everything from everybody else. And you know, you have the same kind of issue they had last year with Dellavedova. It's nice that they have Mo Williams on top of him, and, you know, Mo can do more, and so you're asking Dellavedova to do less. But Mo is not active defensively, and so you're going to have to – David Blatt's going to have to struggle this stretch without Kyrie to figure out what he can get out of each of them and how you want to balance those trade-offs.
Kirk Heinrich played 0 minutes tonight.
He did.
And that's pretty remarkable. Etuan Moore got some of the rotation minutes, and so it's pretty remarkable. Aaron Brooks had a pretty bad game. He had one stretch where he either shot or turned it over on 4 straight possessions and had basically one pass in those 4 possessions, and then just immediately got the ball right back on a dribble handoff before trying to shoot again. So that was pretty ugly when the Bulls actually had staked out to, a 13-point lead in the third quarter and gave all that up with LeBron on the bench, which was something they did off in the playoffs last year as well. What did you see as far as the Bulls that were differences under Hoiberg compared to Tibbs?
I think that they were, it felt to me, and this, you know this team far better than I do, like they were starting to get into actions a little bit earlier. It seemed like there were more branches off of, even if the trees were similar, like they were doing some more different things off of it. But for me, the biggest difference was that they actually played Mirotić with the starters. I mean, I think that was an element that you and I clamored for basically all of last year. And I don't exactly, you know, I think we both have a feeling on what their ideal front court pairings are, but I think the idea of playing a 4 who can actually shoot with Rose and Butler is just gigantic for what they can do with that first unit.
Yeah, that's good. And I think that's part of why he had a good plus minus in this game.
McDermott was alive too.
Yeah. Although, and I thought I liked what Hoiberg did, basically only playing McDermott when LeBron was out. I thought that that was a smart move. And because if he gets switched on to LeBron, it's basically all over. A couple other thoughts. He basically was playing the bigs in only 6 minute stints or so. And he would then just take them out and put them back in. Those guys were fresh. That was, I think, very important in keeping Cleveland off the offensive glass, although those guys are not quite in the physical condition they were last spring, so we don't want to draw too much from that. The faster pace, I mentioned. Not playing Heinrich, I mentioned. Let's see, what else was
there? The Bulls only had 13 assists on 37 made baskets.
Cleveland played good defense in this
game.
They
did.
I have to give them credit. They only gave up, the Bulls were only 9 out of 19 at the rim. That's not a lot of shots at the rim. They didn't shoot that many threes, though they shot a good percentage on them, 9 out of 19. So they took 38, kind of what you would think of Morey ball shots, and then they took 48 shots in the kind of dead zone in between those areas and didn't get to the foul line a ton, only 23 attempts. So I thought, especially for a Cleveland team that, with Thompson trying to get back into shape, Anderson Varejao looked pretty useless when he was out there, unfortunately. Sasha Kahn didn't play at all. So, yeah, I think Cleveland's going to be hurting a little bit, especially offensively, for a play from the bigs. But they were missing Shumpert in this game. Rose was able to drive by Mo Williams whenever he wanted to. And so to be able to defend as well as they did against a Bulls team that should be a pretty high-powered offense is encouraging for their ability to kind of stay afloat during this period when all these guys are out.
And while I wouldn't consider it a necessarily strength for the Bulls, they did only have 7 offensive rebounds. So that's another way when you're thinking about how you're stopping a team is if you're not only they're not getting looks at the rim, but you're not giving them second chance looks.
Yeah, Gasol, he did have the 6 blocks in this game, although he was taken advantage of most of the night in pick and roll when the Cavs just went after him in the fourth quarter with LeBron. But more disturbingly, only 1 out of 7. Really, just when Mozgov is in there, Gasol just has zero chance of posting him up. And it gives you, Gasol killed it at Eurobasket, obviously, but he's just he's not strong enough to back down into close enough range against a guy like Mozgov, a true NBA size center. And then it leads to tough fadeaways, hook shots going across the lane, but when he kind of gets bumped off his stride a little bit by good post defense. So I continue to think that Gasol should come off the bench and Noah should start, especially with how good he looked defensively, how spry he looked, and that Gasol can be a focus of that second unit where he can eat against some of the smaller backups and be a hub of the second unit. Because when in that end of the third quarter, for example, when the Cavs made that comeback with LeBron out of the game, the Bulls had Rose, Butler, Mirotic, and Gasol all on the bench. That's their 4 best offensive players. And shockingly, they went scoreless for about 4 minutes.
I really like the idea of Gasol being the anchor for the second unit. And it also helps mitigate the problem that they have a backup point guard. That he can do that. So then you're asking Brooks to be more of a catch and shoot guy, which is closer to his skill set, in my opinion. So yeah, I think that's the end game. And I think people sometimes get too fixated on who starts and who doesn't, but at the same point, where you get your minutes and who you get your minutes with definitely does matter.
Yeah, and also just every lineup that you put out there needs to make sense, right? You need to look at a lineup and be able to have a reasonable answer to the question, how is this team going to get its points? And, at one point, the answer to that question was Aaron Brooks going one-on-one every time. So how are you going to create a good shot? And, they just didn't have any of their 4 best options out there. And that kind of made it difficult. Any thoughts about the end of the game at all? I mean, this actually did come down to be a 1 possession game improbably at the end.
Nothing that I can specifically think of. I was just as somebody I guess the word would be caped for him for such a long time. It was exciting to see Love make those big shots, even though this wasn't a big game in any traditional sense. But
oh yeah, what did you think? Sorry to interrupt you, but what did you think of how they used them? I didn't really see much different from last year, frankly. I was not, they at least got him a couple of post-ups on Mirotić right under the rim. But other than that, I didn't see anything particularly imaginative. It was all just spot-ups from him. He wasn't really that involved in the passing game. They didn't really do much screening action for him. They didn't break out any of those cool Minnesota plays that they used to run for him. So I was a little discouraged by that, especially considering that they don't really have anyone else to go to right now besides LeBron.
I was discouraged by that. I thought he made some nice plays in transition. I think people lose track of the fact that he's a very intuitive, good passer, and he had one beautiful.
Oh yeah, he had some great outlets. The Cavs got maybe four or five runouts in this game that were kind of inexcusable from the Bulls, but also the result of great passes many times by Love.
And people think of him, I think, just as an outlet passer, which he's legitimately great at. But also he had one. I think he was just past the half court line, and he threw a bounce pass to, it might have been Richard Jefferson. And it was just like, oh yeah, he can do that too, because I've been a fan of his for a long time and thought that he would be a useful piece on a good team because he can do things like that, and at least if he's doing it in transition, that's a step, and it's not everything that I want, but it's something.
Yeah, the end of the game, Love hit a couple of threes to bring the Cavs back close, and the Bulls are really on their heels. 10 seconds left. Of course, the possession ends in a predictable, terrible Rose 19-footer, and the Cavs get the defensive rebound, and they call timeout. And with 10 seconds left, there's just no reason not to just push the ball up the floor there. If you're not in the process of getting something decent, then you can call timeout. You still have about 6 seconds left. They had the Bulls on their heels, and as it turned out, LeBron is able to get to the basket. Gasol made an heroic block. Someone said on Twitter that 2012 LeBron ends Gasol's life on that play. I wouldn't say that. It was more that LeBron wasn't quite quick enough to turn the corner on him, and so Gasol was still there. And great job blocking the shot with his left hand there by Gasol, too. He's like a 7'5 wingspan, and that's why you block shots with your left hand, kid, when the shooter is right-handed. And then Jimmy Butler did a great job denying on the inbounds. And I think, were the Cavs out of timeouts at that point? I think they must have been for Mo Williams to have had to force it in like that.
Yeah, something I wanted to ask you about is I've always been of the opinion that in those kinds of circumstances, as long as you have somebody who's a competent passer who's taller than 6'1", I always like using somebody because you can put all you have to do in that circumstance where you have a limited amount of time is if you put somebody taller on them, it just makes life hard on them.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think that they necessarily. Who was on Mo Williams? Because Rose was guarding Dellavedova, so it must have been Snell.
I think Snell is what's in my head.
Yeah.
And then Butler was close by because Butler made the tip before anybody could touch the ball on Cleveland. And
also, J.R. Smith got a technical, was taken out. They put in Dellavedova. Maybe it was kind of a disciplinary thing. They were making the comeback, but you might as well put J.R. Smith back in for those last two chances when they had taken timeouts. Dellavedova basically, not someone who's going to get the ball in that situation, not going to do anything except shoot a spot-up three when he's wide open with 3 seconds left, not going to prevent help. It wasn't fatal to the play because Rose was actually sitting pretty close to him, but didn't really make sense to leave him in instead of JR, who's someone who can hit a real tough shot and that you're not going to want to leave in that situation. But so not a huge deal, but something I would have noted there from Blatt.
Yeah, I thought about that too. And one thing that I kind of Klay Thompson crystallized, we talked about it a little bit earlier, is the idea that even if somebody isn't the primary focus on a play, diverting attention is something that is valuable there. And so if you can just have somebody who the other team has to be scared of, as opposed to somebody who they go, if he gets the ball, that's probably going to be a successful possession for us. So if you can just minimize those people in a situation where it's 3 seconds left and you're down by two, I think you're doing yourself a big favor.
All right, that's about all I had on this game. We'll close with, we'll probably kind of throw in these features a little bit every once in a while with these kind of game wrap-up nights, but I wanted to do a player of the night for each of us. Who's yours?
Stephen Curry. He was magnificent.
This just in.
I mean, he had 20 points in the first quarter.
24 points.
24 in the first quarter. Oh, yeah, I was thinking of when he hit 20. He had 40 after three, and what you get in these moments with him is it's not only the big things. People think about the scoring explosions, but he has his dribbling was great tonight. His passing was phenomenal tonight, and he is the best offensive player in the league for a reason. It's not just that he's the best shooter alive or that he's maybe the best shooter of all time. It's that he does the other things that a point guard primary ball handler does well on top of that.
Yeah, he's just added even more dribble moves now. His shooting looks as good or better than it did. I mean, he clearly has added to his game. He doesn't, you know, I thought maybe there's some chance that last year would be the best year of his career, and that may still be the case, but he certainly doesn't look to have fallen off any, that's for sure, especially after having a great preseason. I think his confidence and I'm also looking forward to his sort of trolling and shit-talking kind of going to another level like it did in that play in the preseason when he high-fived Iguodala before his shot even went in. I mean, he had one fake today where it wasn't even a shot fake. He just put his legs together like he was about to shoot, and Nate Robinson just jumped at him, and then he blew by him and blew by Perkins, who is the big defender and is way too far out in space, and you know, just did like a nice little one-hand speed layup. It was fantastic. He had so many great plays. I would say my guy, I already talked about KCP. My guy would be Bogut, actually, who looked thinner, did not have a good preseason, but he was, I think, 6 out of 6 for 12 points in this game, was able to get free, looked really nice, maneuvering to the basket, had some dunks, was able to defend the rim pretty well, and, of course, got some sort of a bloody head. Once again, he lacerated his head for 3 stitches against Dante Cunningham. And one thing I would say, too, that bodes a little bit well for the Pelicans, this isn't really related to the one player, but I forgot to mention it. Dante Cunningham looked very good shooting 3-pointers in this game. He was 2 out of 2, and if he can turn all those long 2s into 3s, he can be more playable offensively at the 3, and even, I think, could be really good playing minutes as a small ball 4 with Davis at the 5. That could probably be ultimately their best defensive lineup. But yeah, and I think the last thing too is just that AD did not have a good defensive game, and you know, the Pelicans, granted, this is the absolute hardest opponent to play when you have 2 point guards off the street signing the last week, so I wouldn't take too much away from it, but still not a incredibly encouraging start.
Something else to think about with Dante Cunningham is that if Ryan Anderson is not, this is a pretty small if now, but if Ryan Anderson isn't what he was, you know, in his prime, then you're looking for something different at the forward spots, and there's a possibility that Cunningham can be that guy, and if he is, then you start to get closer to him being worth his contract.
Yeah, and if they can get Coupon back and he can actually be the guy that he was last year before he got hurt down the end of the year, then you really open up some intriguing possibilities with switching if you're going to play Cunningham at the 4. Even Evans is a guy who's pretty stout. He could probably switch a little bit if he's playing the 2. So I do like the versatility that this Pelicans team has when they're all healthy. It's just we have no idea when that is actually going to be. And that's my big takeaway from tonight is Cleveland, I thought they're going to be really injured and struggle. They gave me no reason to dispel that belief tonight. And same thing with the Pelicans.
Yeah, what I found different between Cleveland and New Orleans, and a lot of that is because of just the sheer talent on their team, was that I feel like New Orleans, the guys who played, did a reasonably good job. And with Cleveland, it feels like not only are they missing players, but the guys they have are going to take some time to get to where they need to be.
Yeah, that's important too. I mean, Mozgov had some quotes saying he didn't quite feel right in the last week or so. Thompson, Love still kind of getting back into the swing of things as well. Bergeau, another guy coming off injury. I think until I see something different, I mean, torn Achilles is really bad. He's pretty old anyway, and you know, wasn't really even all that effective last year when he did play. So until I see something different, I'm going to kind of assume that he's like not really going to be able to contribute much this year. So yeah, I mean, they got to get those guys back and playing well. I mean, the good thing is that LeBron looked fine from a health standpoint after the back issues that he had. So that's at least somewhat encouraging. But again, they're going to have to monitor his minutes load as well. How many minutes did he play tonight?
Let me look.
36 minutes.
Okay.
So in a game that they're trying to win, I think that's a good number for him. He probably should not be exceeding that, frankly, if they want to keep him healthy. But even that might be slightly more than they want to be playing him once Kyrie and Love and all and Love is back to 100%.
Well, that's something to think about as well with Cleveland, especially during the stretch, is that the Warriors have had the benefit last year of that they were blowing teams out so much early that they didn't need to play their starters as much. Cleveland, I don't think they're going to be doing that for a while. You know, this isn't a team that has that. But what I kind of gained, I was not the opposite of depressed about, was that they did a decent job fighting, considering the guys that they were missing were so important against Chicago in particular. You know, I figured that was going to be a much bigger thing, not having Shumpert in particular guarding Derrick Rose. But, you know, they were competitive. They weren't perfect. The Bulls didn't play a perfect game, but they were in it more than I expected.
So what's your big takeaway? Do you have one? Do we?
I don't know that I really... I think the big takeaway is that the Pistons are closer than I thought they were.
Yeah, now, we are legendary, of course, everyone is, to overreacting to opening night, but I really liked some of the things that I saw from them that I think are sustainable, ultimately, whether it's Drummond's energy, he just, the level of effort that he was able to give, especially on the offensive glass, just relentlessly pursuing every offensive rebound, was really, really impressive. What KCP was able to give them, I don't expect him to be the same offensively, but I think he can replicate that defensive performance, and I think that they get enough shooting out of those, either Morris or Ilyasova, one of those guys can get hot most nights and provide some good three-point shooting. So that's another reason to feel good about the Pistons. And, you know, you picked them for the eighth seed. I had them ninth. I feel, you know, better about that after tonight, obviously, than I did before, but obviously it's a long season.
Yeah.
All right, anything else that struck you, or should we go into our awesome outro here?
I think we should go into the outro. Tomorrow will be very different, because instead of focusing on a small group of games, we get to actually see a wider swath of the league, and there'll be a lot more to learn, even though nothing is definitive this early.
What are you going to watch tomorrow?
Oklahoma City, San Antonio is definitely going to be the headliner, but late, I'm very intrigued to see what the Kings look like. This is a team that I've admitted in every outlet that has asked me.
They play the Clippers at home.
Correct. That I've had trouble figuring them out. You're not going to learn everything against the Clippers. You're not going to learn everything early, but I want to see how it goes.
Anything to plug before we go?
I wrote a piece for Real GM about kind of why I think the Cavs are the most likely champion, and basically what it gets into is the idea of getting to the finals versus winning the finals. And so it was kind of, for me, it was a way of writing out my thought process on it, because I felt really uncomfortable, because I feel the Warriors are the best team in the league, for why I wasn't picking them to win the title.
Yeah, I understand that thinking. And it pains me to not pick the team that I think is the best to win the title, though, and that's probably why I went with the Warriors. For me, I actually had a couple pieces go up. I did a piece on the Terrence Jones and Dinas Mataunas potential extensions, which I don't expect to happen. Oh, I know what we had to talk about. We totally forgot about this.
Barnes and Azili
not extending.
For now. I'm of the mind with all of these things, as I always am, that until we pass the second, that the door is not closed forever. But if Harrison Barnes basically...
Well, Bob Myers announced, for those who missed it, that they are suspending negotiations until next summer. The deadline's November 2nd, but he said, at Harrison's request, which, you know, I don't know how much of that I necessarily believe, but at Harrison's request, he wants to focus on the season. Sam Amick reported that part of the reason that Barnes didn't want to sign up is that if they're not going to pay him a premium, he wants to not be under contract next summer so that he can control his fate instead of just getting traded away by the Warriors. And there seemed to be kind of an undercurrent just in talking to people, reporters who talk to people, not anyone associated with the team, that they might try to do more in 2016, even though my conclusion in my piece about the Barnes and Azili extensions was it would be extremely, extremely hard for them to do that. And then Azili, there hasn't been any formal announcement, but Mark Spears said, a source, probably Azili's agent, said that there have not been any talks whatsoever on an extension, and that Azealia is expected to enter restricted free agency next summer.
A term that you and I have used a lot over this summer that I think is going to be relevant in the next couple months, well, and especially next summer, is the term life-changing money. And I am consistently floored when a player takes a risk when life-changing money is on the table.
Yeah, but, it's... But we don't even know if there was ever anything on the table to Azealia.
Well, we know there was. We have a pretty good idea there was for Barnes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was reported at 4 for $64, so $16 million a year, basically. And you wonder at what Barnes's demands really were. And my thought always was, and we talked about this a lot in our mock extension podcast. I talked about it a lot in the article that I wrote at Nylon Calculus. That basically, once you get above about $17 million a year, the downside is that you're paying him 21 or 22 at the absolute worst, 22 in the summer of 2017, when I think they're more likely to make some moves. But that's that's not that big of a difference. And so why lock in, take on all the risk of him when your downside is paying $4 million more a year when the cap's going to be 90? It's not really that bad of a downside. So put the risk on Barnes and see what he does this year.
And also, something for Barnes when you're thinking about the calculus that he's going, if the logic is that he was worried about being traded, odds are the teams that are going to be willing to give him the money he wants aren't going to be the best teams, because you have to remember that this is after the moratorium. So this is the teams that struck out, unless you're going to see, because you're not going to see the other players. Wait, I believe the moratorium next year is even longer. It's 11 or 12 days. From what I recall. So I can understand the desire to want to control your own destiny, but I don't think he's going to be choosing between great options at that point.
Yeah, that may be true. And maybe they will just end up totally renouncing his capital. I mean, I think the only person who's on the free agent market that's a better fit for them is KD. So maybe they sniff around there. And then if it doesn't happen, and they would have to move, they would have to totally renounce. This is what they would have to do to get enough money for KD unless a trade were involved. They would have to get rid of Sean Livingston, who is $3 million guaranteed. They would have to get rid of Jason Thompson, which they'll probably do anyway. He only has $2.65 million guaranteed. That gets you down to about the cap. Then you have Barnes, about $9 million cap hold. Azealia, about $5 million cap hold. You now have to renounce both those guys. Now you're about $14, $15 million in space. Then you got to dump Iguodala or Bogut, who are both going to have cap numbers of around $11 million. Bogut actually is supposed to have more, but that's because he made second-team all-defense last year, and his bonuses are now considered likely. He gets, I think, a 15% bonus from that. That's worth a little over $1.5 million. And so... He's probably not going to do that this year, and then his cap number will get kicked down next year back to $11.1 million. But he and Iguodala both make that. You have to dump one of those two guys, and then you can get the space for Durant. And if you do get Durant, I mean, that's obviously a super team for a long time. You do it. But that team would then have the room exception and minimum contracts, and you would have no backup point guard, no backup bigs, no backup wings. So it would definitely be a fairly thin team, and maybe not a surefire title team, just for that reason, unless they can really get some awesome minimum guys in there. So that's why I think 2016 is pretty unlikely, especially that the idea that Durant would even want to come there to begin with. So I think it's more likely going to be 2017.
The only thing that I'll add on that, as somebody who's written about the possibility, is that they don't have to play those games. They don't have to make any commitments to that unless Durant says yes. Those guys are good enough players. They'll be desirable enough. They'll be expiring contracts, and then we don't know with Barnes and Azealia. And so they can do that, and if Durant is committed, then they can do that. They could even, theoretically, using the moratorium to their advantage, they could conceptually use their leverage with matching rights and try to even sign and trade Barnes, so they could do kind of what the Kings did with Tyreek. There are ways that you can finesse this a little bit, but the most important thing to remember is, while the Warriors would have to do that, they have the power to be able to do that only if the situation comes to pass.
Do you know how many minutes Festus Azealia played last year?
It was less than 500, right?
504.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, and he did have a very good year, and he had a bad stint in the first half today, a really nice stint in the second half after Bogut went out. And his offensive rebounding, especially when you consider how spaced the floor is for this team and how far the other team's bigs have to get away from the basket, can be a really nice weapon. I do think he has like a little bit of a Gorgui Dieng to him at times where he'll be right there and just doesn't block the shot for some reason. I think a lot of that is he never uses his left hand to block shots, but he also had some nice instances of individual post defense on Anthony Davis, which had been he'd been a little jumpy in post defense previous times, so maybe that's something that he's improved a little bit this year. So we'll see, but I certainly understand not wanting to commit eight figures to someone who's played 500 minutes over the past 2 years.
And whose best time was in the finals in what was a very weird series.
Yeah, that's true. One other article to plug to on the Cauldron with Sports Illustrated. I wrote a piece about players who have small cap holds for next year, and I got deep into the Jordan Clarkson situation as well and what it means for the fact that he's could be subject to the Arenas rule. If you don't know what that is a great piece for you to read on that.
Can I say something quick? Beyond the fact that that's a great piece and people should read it, is that I've brought back to a new site I've written what's been called Non-National Games of the Week. It's a piece that I love doing. I've done it for Real GM. It is now at the Sporting News, and I think it's being called League Pass Alert now. And so it's the games that I think are worth watching that are on League Pass that aren't on NBA TV or the major networks. And so I would say it's something to kind of keep track if you're thinking about what you want to watch. And while Nate and I have our own patterns and have different things, it is a good guideline for kind of what I'm probably going to be watching, if that matters to you.
What are some of the ones you have for this week? It's actually a great companion to this show because presumably people are listening to this, hopefully religiously, every single day to get their NBA fix.
My game of the week is Rockets Heat. I just think that's a game that we'll learn a lot about. I'm excited about Clippers Kings, which I talked a little bit about for tomorrow. I'm trying to remember what else during the week. Tomorrow, the other one for those of us who are big man nerds is Gobert Drummond, which is Jazz Pistons. I'm really excited. I'm not sure I'm going to watch that whole game, but I'm very excited in the early.
Yeah, I'm going to feel a little guilty about watching the Pistons two nights in a row, but I do really want to see
That's why tonight. I was going to de-emphasize the Pistons tonight, and you know, I didn't watch as much of it as I kind of wanted to, but we had other obligations.
All right, let's get these guys out of here. This is probably actually a little bit longer than we'll normally go, but the Barnes and Azili thing definitely deserved some comment. If you would like to support the show, which would be awesome, there are many ways to do so. An iTunes rating or ranking would be one that's really helped get some new people to listen to the show with our growth. My or Danny's Facebook page is a good place to keep up with our articles. Follow us on Twitter. He's Danny LaRue. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. Also, our sponsors are definitely a great way to support the show as well, be it DraftKings or SeatGeek with the cap space code, all one word. And that'll do it for tonight. We'll talk to you all next time.